I came across some tombstone epitaphs that caught my attention. Beneath this stone, my wife doth lie. Now she's at rest. So am I. Here lies as silent clay Miss Arabella Young, who on the 21st of May began to hold her tongue. Here lies Johnny Yeast, pardon me for not rising. The original story was that someone found this tombstone buried deep under grass and pulled the grass aside. It said, "Pause, stranger, when you pass me by, for as you are, so once was I. As I am now, so will you be. So prepare for death and follow me." Pushing the grass further aside, they found this other note scratched with a crude instrument. "To follow you, I'm not content until I know which way you went." And this, "Here lies an atheist, all dressed up and no place to go." And in contrast, "Here under this sod and under these trees is buried the body of Solomon Pease. But here in this hole lies only the pod. His soul is shelled out and gone up to God." John Hodgman died January 14, 1852, aged 52. "Death, thou hast conquered me. I by thy dart am slain. But Christ has conquered thee, and I shall rise again." Which is it for you, all dressed up with no place to go? Or, "Death has conquered me, but I shall rise again"? If it's the latter of the two, I ask you, are you certain? More than any other subject, death presses us to consider what we truly believe. Our text today is the final one in the book of Genesis. I can't even remember the first sermon in Genesis, and I preached it. 50-some sermons later, we come to this last text in Genesis. We arrive at the end, and I thank you for not applauding that we finally finished a book. In our final text, two deaths are recorded. The events, and particularly the words surrounding those two deaths, I believe form the emphasis that Moses wishes to make by telling us about those two deaths. I'd like to read the text for today. And in so doing, I have skipped some passages for the sake of time. I would ask you to begin at chapter 49, verse 29. And I will tell you when I move from, when I skip some of the text. I'll give you the next verse reference. Would you stand with me, please, in honor of God's word? "Then Jacob gave his sons these instructions. I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite, the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre in Canaan, which Abraham bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite along with the field. There Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried, there Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave in it were bought from the Hittites." When Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father in Israel. So the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming, and the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Verse 12. "So Jacob's sons did as he had commanded them. They carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which Abraham had bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite along with the field. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt together with his brothers and all the others who had gone with him to bury his father." Verse 22. "Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all his father's family. He lived 110 years. Verse 24, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place. So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. You may be seated. As you were reading, undoubtedly you noted the two deaths, but what I wanted you to pick up on was that the same basic request was made by both men in regard to their deaths. And what was that same request, or basically the same request, that these two men made? It was, don't bury me in Egypt. Do bury me in Canaan, the promised land. Now, what's so significant about that? Isn't it very common for people to want to be buried in their hometown or their homeland? We often hear of people requesting that their bodies be taken back to Nebraska or Texas or California, even though the memorial service may be held here. They speak of cemetery plots that have already been arranged in their the country where they prior, or the state where they lived before. Is that all this is? Absolutely not. Both of these men, according to Moses, both of these men are making a huge statement about the future. As each of these men draws close to his death, he is staking a claim on the future. And what was that future that they saw for themselves and for their families? I'll tell you about it with more specificity in a moment, but it is the promises of God. They were staking their future on the promises that God has made. By faith, they believed more in what God had promised would come than they even believed in what they could see with their own eyes. What did they believe about the future? First of all, what didn't they believe? For the contrast is striking. Neither Jacob nor Joseph had any future in Egypt. That is, they did not see a future for themselves in that country. I say that is impressive when you consider who those men were and the positions they held at the time of their deaths. Wouldn't it have been natural for both Jacob and Joseph to have seen their futures and the futures of their children in that land? After all, Joseph was the prime minister of the country, number two in command. After all, Jacob and his sons had been given the very best land in the country on which to build a future. Wouldn't you expect Joseph to have imagined his children getting educated in the finest Egyptian schools, having imagined his children one day joining him in government service, imagining his children having all of the prosperity and enjoying the very best that Egypt had to offer? Isn't it easy to think of Jacob imagining his sons' herds increasing, their prosperity increasing, and the comfort and good life, no, the excellent life which they could have in Egypt being more and more theirs? I find it amazing that these two men did not see their future in Egypt. Instead, they saw their future in Canaan. Why? Because God had said, Canaan will be your home. They believed the promise of God. To Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and to Jacob's sons, God had reiterated the promise that he would make of them a great nation, that they would have a land of their own, and that God would bless the world through them. Now, Joseph had all of the power and wealth of Egypt at his disposal, but he believed more in the promise of God about a future that he couldn't see than he even did in the promise of a future in Egypt. And he had lived his life that way. He believed so firmly in that future that God had promised that he adjusted everything in life around that picture of the future. He had resisted great temptation. Joseph had endured patiently and faithfully through slavery and unjust imprisonment for 13 years because he believed in God's promise for the future. And now at his death, he is still betting his and his family's future on the promises of God, more so than on all that Egypt had to offer, and Egypt had a lot to offer them. What he believed about the future affected everything he did in the present. It is rightly said that your present life determines your future life. But it is just as rightly said that your future determines your present. Joseph made decisions in this life based on what he believed about the future, even though he could not see that future. What do you believe about the future? And how does that belief, how does that picture of what is going to take place, how does it impact your present life? Does what God says about the future determine the way you spend your money and your time and the way you live your very life? Is it that picture of the future that determines everything else about who you are and what you do? The book of Genesis ends with a note of great expectancy. In fact, it's in these deaths, particularly in their words around these deaths, that sound that note of expectancy here at the end of Genesis. Jacob and Joseph had died believing that a day would come when God would deliver on his promises of them having a great nation, a great land, and blessing the world. Nearly 500 years, note the time frame, nearly 500 years later, God in fact did take those people out of Egypt and return them to the promised land and blessed them beyond measure in the years to come. The book of Genesis ends with an air of expectancy, and in the years to come, we see that God delivers, even though it's 500 years later. The Old Testament itself likewise ends on a note of expectancy. In the 1,500 years that followed Moses leading the Israelites, the descendants of Jacob, out of Egypt into the promised land, in those 1,500 years, the people of God, though blessed immeasurably, nonetheless failed God miserably. During that time, as God judged his people, he would over and over again promise them that their salvation and their future lay in a coming Messiah. And so when we come to the end of the Old Testament, in fact, it's the last book, last chapter, we see that air of anticipation registered once again. Malachi 4, "For you who revere my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings." Only one Old Testament allusion to the coming Messiah, but when we come to the New Testament, we see in Zechariah's words, using the same words that had been used in Malachi, Jesus is that Son of Righteousness. He is the fulfillment of the anticipated Messiah. Not only does Genesis end with an air of expectancy, not only does the Old Testament itself in its entirety end with an air of expectancy, but so too does the New Testament end with a note of expectancy when Jesus himself declares, speaking of his second coming in Revelation 22, "Yes, yes, I am coming soon." Do you believe it? Does that picture of the future, of Jesus' return, color everything you are and do in this life? What future do you see? And do you base your life on that future? Here's what Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph saw. Mind you, this is the word of God to Abraham 100 and some years before the deaths of Jacob and Joseph. And here's what God said to Abraham, and Jacob and Joseph knew these words. "I will make you fruitful," God said. "I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien," remember God speaking to Abraham even before they went to Egypt, "the whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God." What did Jacob and Joseph see? They saw a day when they would be in their own land. They saw a day when they would number hundreds of thousands with nations within nations, and so prosperous and influential would they be that there would be kings among them. They saw a day when a great and prosperous land and a great and prosperous people would enjoy the very presence of God himself, and they would live a whole new way of life. What future do you see? What's coming out there? What is it really? God has said in his word, that there's coming a day when our bodies will be resurrected from the graves and they will be transformed into new bodies that will know nothing of the limitations and the suffering that we now know. God has said that this old earth and universe will pass away and that God is going to create a new earth and a new universe, not like this sick one, and sick it is ever since sin entered it. And God is going to create that new earth, and it's going to be more glorious than anything we could possibly imagine. And on that new earth, we are going to live forever and ever. And God has said that on that new earth, we will live forever in His presence. We will know Him more intimately than is even possible now. And those who love Him will be with Him and with each other on this new earth forever and forever. And book after book of the New Testament, Romans and 1 Corinthians and Thessalonians and Peter and Revelation, paint this picture of what it will be. I've emphasized before that the heaven that most people speak of when a loved one dies today is not the heaven that is the completion of the story that God has for His people. Heaven, as it often today is now experienced, is not what God has saved us for. The future of God's people is not completed when we are absent from the body and present with the Lord. The completion is the new earth. The completion are resurrected bodies on that new earth. The completion is living in the presence of God forever in that place. As God's people, we don't look forward to death. We look forward to resurrection. That's the end of the story. I find it quite difficult to get young people very excited to talk about or even think about death and heaven. And I think one of the reasons is because the way it is often presented is so limiting. I think it would be quite a different story. I think they could get excited if they understood that what the future is about is a resurrection to a world that is radically different than the one in which we now live, and living among a people that are radically different than what we now experience. That kind of future, anyone ought to be able to get excited about. That's the future we have to look forward to. That's the future that shapes our present lives. That's the invisible that we see with eyes of faith, as much as Jacob and Joseph saw the invisible with their eyes of faith. So many of us, men and women, are people of the present. That is, we find it almost difficult to imagine the future. It seems that the best we can often do is imagining the next party that's coming, or imagining ourselves getting a certain promotion at work, or imagining ourselves being able to purchase something we've wanted for a long time, or possibly imagining ourselves with a certain security and plenty in our retirement. But God has called us to be men and women of the future. The future that He has painted. Men and women who, with eyes of faith, see clearly and believe the future that God has promised. That's the kind of men Abraham and Jacob and Joseph were. It's a long passage, but I want you to hear it with new ears, especially in light of our study in Genesis, and especially in light of these two death reports at the end of Genesis, and hear what a New Testament author says about these people and their faith in that future that God had promised. Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. They were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Let me stop there for a moment and make you realize, or draw you to realize, that this New Testament commentator, commentating on those Old Testament incidents, is saying this: Abraham and his descendants, those who were God followers, were not only looking forward to the promised land, Canaan, but they realized, to some degree, they realized that that was looking forward to something far greater that was yet to come. something God alone could do. Therefore, trusting in that vision of the future, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. It is what we don't see with our physical eyes that determines who we are and what we give our lives to. It is that which makes it possible for us to struggle through untold burdens in this life with a certainty that these struggles are not the last chapter in the story. It is that picture of the future that makes it possible for us to stand by the casket of a loved one and say with confidence, "This is not the end. I know what is coming, and this is not the end of the story." I know it's an old story, possibly told too many times, but I like it nonetheless, especially in this context. It was of a missionary couple returning after 40 years of service in a difficult country among difficult people. As they stepped off the plane, they could not help but notice the very large crowd that had gathered around to welcome a dignitary who was also on the plane. The missionary turned to his wife and remarked with a certain degree of self-pity how that it was too bad that they had not been so enthusiastically welcomed home. And his wife smiled and said to him, "Just remember this, we aren't home yet." That's the truth. We'll be home when Christ comes back. We'll be home when our bodies are resurrected. We'll be home when we live on the new earth in the presence of Almighty God forever and forever. Faith sees the invisible and orders one's life around that truth. Now, not only did Jacob and Joseph see the future with eyes of faith, they also believed it so thoroughly that they were not put off by delay. And they were not discouraged by opposition. By the time Jacob and then Joseph died, the promise of God regarding this land that would be theirs and this great nation that would be theirs and this world blessing that they would provide, by the time they died, that promise was over 150 years old. I asked you to think about it. How long do you keep a vision alive if nothing's happened? How long do you still keep believing that something is going to take place if it hasn't yet happened? Jacob was an old man, and he was not even in the land that God had promised they would have. He was in Egypt. Surely the vision had faded by that time. Surely Jacob was a man who was tempted, sorely tempted, to say, "Well, maybe we got it wrong. Maybe we didn't understand God." But what do we find instead? Genesis chapters 48 and 49 are the chapters that record Jacob's blessings on his sons and grandsons. It's an amazing couple of chapters. Now remember, Jacob is standing there or sitting there in Egypt with all the power and all the privilege that goes with being the father of the prime minister of that country, with all of the potential that there is for his own sons in the prosperity of that place. But when he blesses them, what does he call them to? What future does he refer to? Them in Egypt? No. He calls them to that future that he sees only with the eyes of faith. He calls them to a future in Canaan itself. Now, mind you, this is even though Jacob understood that in God's promise to Abraham many years earlier, God had said it would be at least 400 years before that promise would be fulfilled. In spite of all of the prosperity of Egypt, in spite of that prophecy of over 400 years before it would come to pass, Jacob doesn't miss a beat, because that God-given picture of the future is so strong, it is so clear, that he not only orders his own life around it, he implores his children to do so as well. Faith overcomes delay and opposition. The author of the book of Hebrews, in the chapter that we looked at just a moment ago, referring to these same men and women, said that even imminent death did not deter them from that vision. He said, all these people were still living by faith when they died. Richard Wurmbrand is a man that is known to some of you. He was a man who, for many years, was involved in smuggling Bibles and other Christian literature through the Iron Curtain into communist countries before the Iron Curtain fell. Before he began that ministry, however, Richard Wurmbrand was imprisoned in his own country for some 14 years because of his commitment to Jesus Christ. For 14 years, he lived in a soundless cell 30 feet beneath the ground. He saw no trees, no sky, no children. He was hungry all the time, being fed only potato peel soup and once in a while a slice of bread. For those 14 years, he was submitted to unimaginable torture to try to get him to renounce his faith, but he would not renounce it. Why not? Again, I wish we had the time to make you think about what that experience must have been like and what it must have been like for 14 years. Why would he not renounce his faith? Because his picture of the future was even stronger and clearer than were his present circumstances. He believed God. I ask you, what is your picture of the future? And does it shape your life now? Does this orientation toward the future mean that real Christians are frankly no earthly good? Does it mean that in fact they only think in terms of that picture and so they don't accomplish much here and now? And the answer is to the contrary. It is the Christians who see the future with eyes of faith that are most engaged in this life now. The greatest benefactors the world has ever seen are those men and women of faith, people who believed as much in the world to come as they believe in this current world. And they are the ones who have engaged this world. They've not withdrawn from it. The most influential Christians are not monks and ascetics, but they are people who have fully lived life. They have not withdrawn into seclusion. They have, in fact, engaged the stuff of life. Think of those faith heroes in chapter 11 of Hebrews. Those were men and women who lived real life. But it was that picture of the future that gave them a perspective on the present. Joseph was a man fully engaged in the present, a Renaissance man almost. Think about the kind of involvement he had in his culture and in leadership and government and all of the rest of it. And yet a man with a very sharp, clear picture of the future. In fact, it's that picture that enabled him to be so fully engaged. The great theologian John Calvin was not somebody who was cloistered. It was a man who took that picture of the future that God had given him from the Scriptures and he applied its principles to life in Geneva, Switzerland, and to all over Europe. The faith of the Puritans, much maligned in our era, the faith of the Puritans laid a foundation for the great social reformations that took place in Britain and America. The spiritual revival of 18th century England that kept her from the same kind of bloody and senseless revolution experienced by other countries. It's that revival that did it. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote this: "When men forget the next world and concentrate only on this present life, this world becomes a kind of living hell with confusion and lawlessness and immorality and vice rampant. It is only men who have a complete view of life who really know how to live in this world. The only man who really respects life in this world is the man who knows that this world is only the entryway to the next world. It is only the man who knows himself to be a child of God and who knows that this is God's world who is really concerned about decency in this world. It is the men and women who, with eyes of faith, see the life to come who are most engaged in this life." I ask you, what is the future that you see? How clearly do you see it? How much does it impact who you are and what you do in life? With eyes of faith, do you see the promise that God has made? Does it shape you? Christian men and women are to be men and women of the future. Yes, we know the past. Yes, we engage the present, but it's because we are men and women of the future. Are you? Let's pray.